If you'd like to help them by becoming a collector for the Poppy Appeal, call 0800 1939 45 now. The Poppy Appeal. Remember the dead, but don't forget the living.
I'm Petrop Trelawney. Join me from 4 for the latest on life in the world's most exciting city. News, chat, issues that affect you and me. We'll put the Channel Tunnel through its paces, discover why police are angry with the government, and take David Suchet in for questioning on his new West End show.
Petrop Trelawney on London News Talk, 11:52 a.m. A new generation of original radio.
It's coming up to 6:09. As you've been hearing, Gerry Adams invited one of his most bitter opponents to shake hands when he confronted Unionist MP Ken McGuinness. It was a live television debate broadcast in the United States a few hours ago. It was on CNN, so it was not just the United States. Mr. McGuinness told the Sinn Féin president bluntly that he didn't trust him. After all, he was he not, the front man for a vicious organisation which had killed almost 2,000 people over the past 20 or so years. Now, to get a flavour of that broadcast, this is how Mr. Adams challenged his opponent in the head-to-head encounter.
You see, if I wanted an excuse not to talk to Mr. McGuinness, I have plenty of excuses. He is a former member of the UDR, an organisation which was disbanded by the British government because of its involvement and sectarian organizations and sectarian murders. Right. I don't want an excuse not to talk to him. I want to live in peace with him. He lives a very short spot from where I live. Ireland is no bigger than Rhode Island. There are only 5 million people on the island. This man represents a very considerable and significant national minority of people there. There's no difference between us except one of political allegiance.
Well, joining us by telephone from his hotel in Washington is Ken McGuinness. Ken, what value is there, do you think, in this sort of encounter?
I'm not sure, to be quite honest. I think it's important that the American public at least hear that there are two sides to the story and that they get an accurate picture of what the greater number of people in Northern Ireland actually feel. I think you'll agree that Gerry Adams failed miserably to give a single straight answer to any of the questions posed to him, either questions about consent, the consent of the people, taking into consideration the fact that he represents through his party 10% of the people of Northern Ireland and less than 5% of the people of Ireland as a whole. He failed to answer the question about the permanency of the ceasefire. Again and again, he failed to answer that question.
Yeah, well, that's become kind of like a virility symbol. But more to the point from your point of view, Mr. McGuinness, what did you get across?
I got across the fact that the greater number of people in Northern Ireland wish to remain British.
And do you think that's the main point of misunderstanding?
I think it is, yes. I mean, I think that we hear on the American media the importance of Sinn Féin. That's bolstered out of partly because their power comes through the barrel of a rifle. That's exaggerated out of all reason, and tonight people heard from a unionist I hope that was reasonable and structured in what he put, a unionist who answered directly every question that was put to him. That's important, and I think we've got to do it a little bit more.
Isn't the important thing now, important though that debate may have been because of the role of America in the past and possibly, who knows, in the future in Northern Ireland, don't you now have to have a similar debate on British television?
Well, that's perhaps worth consideration. I don't think the people in Northern Ireland need that sort of debate. In fact, I think it's aggravating and does nothing for the community.
Yes, but the United Kingdom is more than Northern Ireland.
I'd be the first to say it. Sorry?
I say the United Kingdom is more than just Northern Ireland. I'm talking about
indeed,
the whole of the UK.
Indeed, I was going on to say that there may be some merit in having a debate in Great Britain. It's something we'll think about and see how the matter develops. We'll see whether there's any real demand. I would imagine that the majority of people in Great Britain also understand fairly well the situation in Northern Ireland. But if they don't, most certainly we could have that type of debate. Let me put it this way, of course. I have appeared for years and years and years on Great British television and radio. I've put the unionist case. Many of my colleagues have. I think there's a reasonably good understanding, and I'm certainly not one to advocate that we have this sort of confrontational debate merely for entertainment. It is a serious issue.
Well, that's the danger, isn't it? And it may indeed have come over on CNN as a spectacle rather than a reasoned debate.
I think there is that danger. Although, mind you, I was surprised by the questions which came in by telephone. They were well structured and intelligent questions, and it did appear as though those who were fortunate enough to be able to get through understood better what the whole issue was about. But
finally,
what I'm saying is, it's necessary. What I'm basically saying is, it's necessary on foreign television because people don't have that in-depth understanding. I'm not sure about Great Britain, and certainly I don't think that there would be much to be gained stage.
You said you're still waiting for the use of the word permanent by Gerry Adams, but apart from that, let's put that on one side, and let me ask you finally how you assess the state of the peace process.
I would love to say that I was happy that it was going to progress smoothly to a happy conclusion. Unfortunately, that is not the case, where you have someone who is merely articulating a mishmash of irrelevancies, as Gerry Adams does, and not addressing the question of permanency, not addressing the question of 100 tons of weapons, then there doesn't appear to be any real intention to move the process forward, and that would make me sad. I hope that pressure can be brought to bear that will change that.
Ken McGuinness in Washington, thank you very much indeed.
Douglas Cameron and Brian Hayes on London News Talk, 11:52 a.m. It is a sector exploding with opportunities. Seize them with the Evening Standard's new section, IT. With careers that challenge...
We need analyst programmers and fast.
An IT security and planning manager.
Safety critical software.
And careers that pay.
25K and a car.
18,000 minimum. The 40,000 mark.
As IT creates the information superhighway, don't get stuck on the hard shoulder. IT appointments. New in the pink pages of the Evening Standard tonight.
I want to introduce you now to our weather lady, Louise Lear. Good morning. We're going to hear a lot from you in the weeks to come, aren't we? And it's a cold one this morning to start with.
It is a cold one, but one of those nice sort of winter, sort of bright, sunny mornings, really. Generally speaking, though, it's not been such an extreme night as yesterday. In fact, temperatures last night didn't get as low as the night before. It's still been fairly cold, with temperatures in the centre around 5 Celsius, and out on the outskirts, it's as low as 2 at the moment. This has also given more rural areas some ground frost, but after dawn, things will start to pick up. Now, there should be quite a bit of sun around this morning, so it's going to be another one of those bright, cold and crisp starts to the day. It's going to be really lovely, actually. By the afternoon, we could see more in the way of cloud around, though, and this will allow the temperatures to rise to 13 Celsius, which is a couple of degrees higher than yesterday. Now, still another dry and cold night to follow, but we will see a more general increase in the temperature over the next few days. And if we quickly quickly just have a look at this. Copycat weather for Thursday. Dry, sunny, but slightly milder. A little more in the way of cloud around by Friday, and it's going to start off bright and sunny, but then we might just see one or two showers edge in towards the evening. Generally speaking, though, not a bad end to the week.
Good. More weather from Louise Lear at 20 minutes to 7. It's hour 6:17, the headlines. The Sinn Féin leader, Gerry Adams, has clashed with the Ulster Unionists over peace in Northern Ireland. And on this programme a few minutes ago, Ken McGuinness told Brian Hayes that he doubts very much whether the peace process will progress smoothly. Strike action is to threaten the Tube, and Haiti's paramilitary killers are told to lay down their arms. 6:18.
Well, the stars of the day are the Princess of Wales, yes, again, and Tony Blair. No surprise there. The public testing of Tony Blair continues. He gave his speech yesterday, and there's a lot about that in the news today. Whether he emerges, though, from the conference at Blackpool as a leader clearly in charge of a united party is rather uncertain. However, he remains at present the most acceptable face of Labour to an electorate which rejected his predecessors for the past 14 years. Our political editor, Ed Boyle, takes a detached look at the qualities of the man who soars above all rivals in the popularity polls.
Bambi is a somewhat unfair nickname. Tony Blair certainly has the fresh face, some of the freckles, and much of the physical stance of Walt Disney's cartoon creature. But to look at the man now, you can almost glimpse an elder statesman to come, in youthful miniature, of course. He's billed as tomorrow's Prime Minister, and Labour has to look forward to tomorrow. But it was in the dark yesterday of Labour's failure when Blair entered full-time politics. He tried to get into Parliament first in leafy Beaconsfield. I well remember covering that by-election in 1982, being aware of a very young man with a very personable grin and a most un-Labour look to him, energetically pressing the home county's flesh, but realistically on a hiding to nothing. But he must have known that too. Labour's vote fell by 10%. And for Labour to win Beaconsfield then or now is still only the stuff of daydreams. Especially then, 1982, Margaret Thatcher was busy consolidating her election victory over Labour, erecting new trade union laws to curb the very power that had helped bring down the Labour government in the so-called winter of discontent. Even then, Mr. Blair may have had a tinge of sympathy for what the Conservatives were doing. He'd witnessed the old trade union laws at first hand. He was a practicing barrister, specialising in labour relations. His casework ranged from unravelling arcane restrictive practices to some of the real iniquities that occur when boss and worker reach loggerheads. His experience in chambers and in court certainly increased his working knowledge and probably helped cement his underlying philosophy as a Christian socialist seeking change. The Christian roots, of course, go deeper, back to his parents. His father, Leo Charles Linton Blair, to be exact. He was a lawyer, too. And the family names of Charles and Linton were handed on to the infant Anthony. For Anthony he was, back in his legal career and his early parliamentary life. Anthony Blair. Rather too many syllables for clubability, perhaps. Tony he would soon become. Now that, of course, was after Sedgefield. Not a by-election, but the real thing this time, the general election of 1983. Neil Kinnock was Labour leader. Sedgefield was and remains Labour land. Durham mining country. A precious, safe seat, hotly contested. The local party general management committee had bravely picked an outsider, albeit with Durham links. But a soft-voiced southerner, he sounded. Even so, they liked what they heard. A passion behind the eyes, as one of them later described it. Plus, an instinct for the hustings. Because Blair had married the daughter of the actor Anthony Booth. Remember him in Till Death Us Do Part? And Booth's new wife was Pat Phoenix of Coronation Street fame. So Blair got his stepmother-in-law to support him on the campaign trail. Never a raving lefty, though. Even a delve through his classroom days reveals no skeletons of raw Marxism. Durham Chorister School, after all, strives for harmony. And at Fettes in Edinburgh and at Oxford, he dabbled inevitably in politics, but not noticeably. Indeed, talent spotters at St. John's College would have been, probably are, surprised. They knew him better for playing in a rock group and producing student review shows. Clever, thoughtful, yes, they all say that. But where was the evidence of that ruthless quality that all successful leaders require? Good debater, though, which is why Kinnock promoted him first into the trade and industry shadow team and then to the Treasury side. And under John Smith, he was a trusted opposition expert on home affairs, able to take on legal bruisers like Michael Howard in the bear pit of Westminster, able to master the detail and field the abuse and sometimes win with wit. If the press gallery in Parliament had any doubts about Blair's prospects, they weren't born of his performance or of the legendary Westminster gossip machine, for no one ever really had a bad thing to say about Mr. Blair. His friend and Shadow Chancellor Gordon Brown might occasionally get very cantankerous with colleagues, but you never heard a whisper of a Blair temper. And perhaps that's the most frustrating thing of all to us journalists. You never really heard or hear anything of the man behind the image. Maybe then the image is the man. I remember fixing a live TV interview with him a couple of years ago. It was time for a Sunday morning. "I'll be there," he said on the phone. "I'll come straight from church." Now, it simply hadn't occurred to me that the man with the Christian socialist label was really a regular churchgoer too. But that may be his electoral strength. What you see and what you hear is precisely what you get with Tony Blair. He doesn't want to hog the limelight. He delegates. He delegates well. His parliamentary friends like Jack Straw and Mo Molam are passionate disciples and supporters. His public relations guru, Alistair Campbell, the former Daily Mirror and Today newspaper political editor, is a shrewd appointment. Political leaders rely on ideas, ideals, and image. Now, the image hasn't been tarnished. The ideals remain intact. The only area of doubt in Bambi's kingdom is the detail of the political ideas. And for that, for all his transparent niceness, for all his devoted team, Mr. Blair may yet require the single-minded artistry of a Walt Disney to make the make-believe believable.
Ed Boyle, our political editor, that was his assessment of the substance of Tony Blair.
Brian Hayes and Douglas Cameron on London News Talk, 11:52 a.m.
I wish I had proof I sent that order for the new washer. I should have gone to the post office and sent a Royal Mail. Recorded.
Now it's 24 and a half minutes past six. We are going to have a glance, our first glance, at today's newspapers. I mentioned just a few moments ago that the stars were today the Princess of Wales and Tony Blair. Spot the difference. What have you noticed, Douglas?
Well, it's very difficult to spot the difference in some of the papers, Brian, this morning. In The Guardian, we have a headline on the front page, "Too Beautiful a Love to Remain Secret." Now, you might think that referred to that book, but in fact it does refer to how Tony Blair made most of the Labour Party really like him yesterday. Tony Blair scooped the Labour Party in his strong arms yesterday, gazed long into eyes like amber pools of light, and told it how deeply he cared. Then, almost before the party knew what was happening, he led it softly yet insistently towards the bedroom door. And The Times, "Dashing Captain Blair woos his fairy princess." His speech over, he knew applause must follow, but there was a moment's pause. The split second before you kiss, when you know it's going to happen, but at the same time are not quite sure, is a moment of ecstasy that can never be repeated.
Oh, and Mrs. Blair, wasn't she sweet when she just looked gazing and lovingly into his eyes and said, "Brilliant."
Yes.
Now, Alistair Campbell, we heard Ed Boyle referring to him just a few moments ago, is still writing his column in the Today newspaper, and he says, "Not since the final 5 minutes of Burnley's playoff final at Wembley, when we won promotion last season, have I been as nervous as I was as Tony Blair rose to speak yesterday. In the past few weeks, For which, apologies to the editor, he says, I've devoted rather more of my time to Mr. Blair than I have to today, but at least the editor thought the effort put in by Mr. Blair and his team into the speech was worthwhile. And so, he says, did the other editors. Whatever central office lines they have tried to spin in their papers this morning, particularly those who made their name in the Thatcher era, it is true to say that Margaret Thatcher and her project, an interesting way to refer to her years of government, got rather more mentions in the speech than Mr. Major and his project, whatever that might be. And of course, just for those who came in late, Alistair Campbell becomes the press man for Tony Blair any minute now. He's not exactly said when, has he?
No, he hasn't. Well, there may be romance in the air as far as the Labour Party conference is concerned, according to The Guardian and The Times, but the Daily Star really gets down to business. Blair's aims are sound, full employment instead of people on benefit, good schools, hospitals and housing, safe streets, prosperity. But we all want those things, says the Star. The big question is how to make them happen and pay for them. He did not have a single concrete suggestion of where the money would come from. We'll give you one guess. Us, the taxpayers, nobody else. And it is the taxpayers who will decide, concludes the Daily Star, if they can afford Tony Blair.
Let me go on to the other princess, this one, the Princess of Wales. There's a Sun Royal poll on their page 3. It's interesting how they've changed the women that featured on page 3 of the Sun. There are 3 pictures of the Princess of Wales. And they asked various questions of their readers. Do you think less of Princess Di? You know, I still get annoyed when they call her Princess Di.
Yes.
You know, she is Diana, the Princess of Wales.
Indeed.
They say, who do you think was to blame for the breakup of the marriage? Charles, 71% thought so. 16% thought that Diana was to blame, and 13% said both. That other question, do you think less of her following the publication of Hewitt's book? Yes, said 28%. No, said 72%.
Well, I wonder if they'll change their minds when they read the Daily Express this morning, because they have a front page exclusive. Princess Diana faces new disclosures about her private life. This was a story, in fact, we brought to you in the 6 o'clock bulletin. A book to be published soon is understood to name a married man who is now the central figure in her life. She turned to him for comfort and support amid the controversy over her alleged affair with royal trader James Hewitt. So, wonder who he is.
Your voice on this program is welcome each morning. You can either phone us or fax us about specific subjects. There's something which we will be talking about a little bit later that I'll be interested to know what you think about. And we have a free call number, so you can jot this down. Make sure that it's always handy. 0500 00 1152. That's the free call number. 0500 00 1152. And you can fax us. If you can write, you can fax. 071 371 2166.
Brian Hayes and Douglas Cameron on London News Talk, 11:52 a.m.
6:29 is the time. News Talk travel time now. Let's say good morning and welcome to the programme, Matthew Schofield.
To you. If you're travelling on the major routes into town, so far doing fairly well. We did have problems a little earlier this morning in the Blackpool Tunnel with an accident on the northbound side. That has now been cleared, thankfully, so traffic in the normal back to its normal self. No serious build-up there as yet. Other problem spots around town to watch out for, though. Chelsea Bridge, you'll find that down to a single lane northbound all this week because of roadworks. That's likely to cause delays back towards Battersea during the course of the morning. And in Hornsey, on Firm Park Road, the temporary traffic lights in the roadworks at the junction with Fairfield Road are out of order this morning. Quite a busy cut-through route, that, just off Tottenham Lane, so may well cause you some problems. On the motorways, the M25 already looking fairly heavy clockwise through the single-lane section of the roadworks at Junction 7 near Reigate, traffic down to about 20 miles an hour there. And roadworks also on the M26 between Rootham and Sevenoaks may cause delays. On the trains, intercity West Coast services between Euston and Manchester being delayed by points problems. Otherwise, though, public transport all moving well. Matthew Schofield for the London News Talk Travel Team.
The news at 6:30, I'm Douglas Cameron. The Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams and the Ulster Unionist MP Ken McGuinness have clashed in a live debate on American TV. It's the first time that members of the two parties have shared a platform. Mr. McGuinness says Sinn Féin must state that the IRA ceasefire is over. But Mr. Adams says the peace process is proof that they can be trusted.
I think we have to build trust. I want to make friends with this man and with those that he represents. We are of the island of Ireland. We live there. We want to live there on the basis of equality.
And you regret some of the actions of your party and your friends in the past?
I have acknowledged in Ireland the suffering that has been inflicted by Republicans upon others. I myself have been a victim of terrorism. I have no monopoly, and those I represent have no monopoly on suffering. I think it's time to put out the hand of friendship.
Talks aimed at averting a tube strike have broken down without resolution, and commuters now face a strike on the London Underground. Last night's meeting between the RMT union and London Underground managers failed to head off a 24-hour walkout, which will start at 7:30 tomorrow night. The chairman of the London Regional Passenger Committee, Rufus Barnes, doesn't think the strikers will get much support from the public.
I suppose it will, to some degree, depend on how much disruption passengers face. It really, at this stage, is very unclear as to how much they're going to face, and we will have to wait and see. But I don't think, in practice, many people do support strikes, especially if those strikes result in disruption to their journeys.
There are fresh allegations this morning surrounding the private life of the Princess of Wales. The Daily Express claims a new book by Andrew Morton will reveal that a married man is now the central figure in Diana's life. It claims that he's comforting her following allegations of an affair with Major Hewitt. At least 9 people have been killed on a group of Russian islands off the north coast of Japan after an earthquake measuring 8.2 on the Richter scale. 2 people died and nearly 200 were injured in Japan itself. Tidal wave alerts were triggered as far away as Hawaii. A quake of 5.8 on the Richter was also recorded in Taiwan. There are no reports of anyone being hurt. The wife of a Conservative MP has drowned in a swimming accident while holidaying in Greece. Catherine Marlowe died on Sunday. The couple had 3 sons and 2 daughters. Last night, Tony Marlowe, the MP for Northampton North, returned home to be comforted by friends and family. Roll-on, roll-off ferries are facing a tough new clampdown on safety following the Estonia disaster. Sweden and Finland have ordered ship owners to wield shut the bow doors of passenger vessels like the one which sank a week ago, killing 910 people. It's 27 minutes to 7.
Douglas Cameron and Brian Hayes on London News Talk, 11:52 a.m. This weekend, which car rental company, beginning today, offers you a Vauxhall Corsa 1.2 LS for just £23 a day? A price that includes unlimited mileage, collision damage waiver, and VAT. Which car rental company, beginning with A? Alamo. We aim to set the highest standard. Find us in Yellow Pages or call 0800 272 300. Alamo features Vauxhall cars.
Labour leader Tony Blair faces a fierce battle with left-wingers today after he signalled his intention to scrap Clause 4 from the party's constitution. At least that's what we thought he meant. NUM leader Arthur Scargill is describing the move, which effectively takes away the party's commitment to public ownership, as, quotes, an act of war. But other union leaders like John Edmonds of the GMB have been a touch more moderate in their turn. It seems most of the party was taken aback by Mr. Blair's comments, but even so, he got the 6-minute standing ovation. I think that was just for turning up. So how's the new-look Labour going down with constituency MPs? On the line now is Judith Church, who's MP for Dagenham. Judith, good morning to you.
Good morning, Brian.
Your first reaction to Tony Blair's speech, were you impressed?
I was delighted with Tony's speech yesterday.
Is that because you agreed with everything he said?
I'm afraid I did, Brian, so I won't be much of an argument for
you. No controversy from Judith.
Well, obviously you've got controversy your end in suggesting that there's going to be a huge battle about Clause 4. Quite frankly, I think there's a tremendous number of people here in Blackpool yesterday who were relieved that Tony spelt this out and made it clear that he's going to change our constitution in consultation, of course, with the local parties and with the national executive. We've got to change. We've got to move on. We've got a constitution from 1918. We've got to move it into the next century. We've got a constitution that was framed almost a century ago. We've got a long way to go. And I think that Tony's right to look at Clause 4, because at the end of the day, we are not now committed to taking into public ownership all the means of production. We're not going to do that. And what's the point of having it in our constitution when it's not a principle of our party? We're going to redefine our principles into ordinary language, things that people understand.
But it has been a bedrock of socialism, hasn't it? Without Clause 4, we really have a very different, and you may say that's a good thing, Labour Party.
Well, we have a more modern Labour Party. We have a new Labour Party, which is looking to the 21st century rather than to the 19th century, when our founding fathers built up the modern constitution for that day, which is not a modern constitution for this day. Sometimes people in the Labour Party are very reluctant to change things. They want to hang on to these totems of the past. But I believe we've really got to move ahead on this one. At the end of the day, what we want to see is industry succeeding for the good of all the people in the country. Now, we know that some industries are important to be in public ownership. I don't think there's anybody in London, I certainly haven't met anybody in my constituency, who wants to see the post office privatised. And yet the government's going ahead with that crazy privatisation. The post office should be left in public hands, where it's in fact the most profitable industry, post office industry in the world.
But many left-wing MPs, left-wing members of the Labour Party are not going to let it go just that easily, are they? Do you expect there to be a lot of internal battling about Clause 4?
Well, you know, Brian, this is really surprising a lot of people. But in fact, a lot of people can now see that isn't this crazy left-right a split over things. I mean, I think about a year ago, there were MPs who would traditionally be called on the left.
Well, Dennis Skinner didn't look terribly happy last night.
Well, he may not have looked happy, but Tony Benn at the Tribune rally, in his speech, never even mentioned Clause 4, so he's clearly not so desperately concerned about it. Another younger left-wing MP came up to me last night and said, it was a good speech, and I said, yeah, great. He said, you look surprised that I should say that. I said, no, I'm not surprised, because over the last year, lots of people have actually been listening to what Tony's been saying, and they've listened to his words, they've seen what he's got to say, and they've understood that what he's trying to do and explain to people is that we've got to put our principles into a modern language. He talked to people yesterday in ordinary language, not the old Labour mumbo-jumbo that nobody can understand. And I think that's why he's going to be so successful as our leader and eventually as Prime Minister, because he can actually communicate with people in a non-political language. I hope I'm managing to do that this morning.
Well, I'd like to hear from some of our listeners this morning, because the line are open on our free call number 0500 001152. I know that's a new number and you're probably used to other telephone numbers, but jot it down and make sure that it's handy. 0500 001152, that's the free call number. You can fax on 071 371 2166. We particularly would like to hear from you this morning on Tony Blair's speech. The question of Clause 4 is one of the most important things. Do you believe that as Clause 4 disappears, so does the socialism of the Labour Party? We're talking to Judith Church at the moment. And just one more reference to these left-wingers. Arthur Scargill is not exactly pleased, is he? He's on the front page of Today in, it must be said, special effects form. Jurassic Park Part 2, it says. Tyrannosaurus Rex, or however you pronounce that, the last roar of the dinosaurs. Well, he may be referred to as a dinosaur, but a lot of people listen to and support him, don't they?
Well, some people do, Brian. I shall look forward to seeing today this morning and what it's got to say. But at the end of the day, we had a huge ballot this year, the biggest ballot there's ever been to elect a leader of a political party in Western Europe. Tony put out very clearly his manifesto for change and national renewal. And he didn't mean just changing the country. He said we had to change ourselves. And then, and I believe this is the issue of trust that we've got with people, if we can't change ourselves, if we can't get the Labour Party into the 21st century, how will people ever believe we're going to get the country into the 21st century? So that's Tony's message. I believe, really, there are going to be a few people, perhaps a sort of dinosaurs. I don't think there'll be a lot of support for it. I honestly believe that there was a collective sigh of relief. Certainly there was a 6-minute standing ovation. A few people didn't get on their feet, but yesterday the hall was full of people up on their feet supporting Tony and what he's going to do. And I think, quite frankly, this will be a little storm in a teacup, Brian.
You've got to be very careful, haven't you, though, that this optimism doesn't get out of hand. I mean, the feeling, it's nice, I suppose, for somebody in the Labour Party to feel next time we'll do it, we will have the government, Tony Blair will be the Prime Minister. But you mustn't get carried away, must you?
Well, I don't think anybody's carried away, Brian. The first thing Tony said in July when he became leader, when he gave his acceptance speech, was there's no room for complacency in the Labour Party. And I can tell you, I'm not complacent. I believe we've got a fight on our hands. We had a very filthy general election campaign from the Tories in 1992 when they lied on tax, they lied on virtually everything. And now I believe that they're going to throw everything at us in the run-up to the next general election. Tony's going to tell the truth. He's not going to promise things that he can't deliver. He made it very clear to conference yesterday that we will get the trust of the British people if we are honest and sincere and we actually lay out what we our vision for the country is in the next century.
Judith, thank you very much indeed. Okay. Judith Church, the MP for Dagenham, certainly will cast her vote for Tony Blair. I mean, if you know what I mean. We would like to know whether you will. Call our free call number 0500 00 1152 or the fax 071 371 2166. A little bit later, I'll be talking to the Conservative Party chairman, Jeremy Hanley.
Blackpool is in the spotlight this week as the country's media focuses on the goings-on at the Labour Party conference. And Ed Boyle, our political editor, has been less than generous about the Northern Resort. You might have heard yesterday a disgraceful broadcast, which I disassociate myself from, so I thought it's only fair that we give Blackpool a chance to answer back. Is it a grim, rain-drenched B&B nightmare or a glowing, fun seaside town?
Simon Bates on London News Talk, 11:52 a.m.
Win a home through the Evening Standard keyhole. Win a superb three-bedroom house with garage quality built by Barrett. Or win a luxury Barrett Thameside apartment with two bedrooms, fitted kitchen, and carpeted throughout. Pick up a game card from your newsagent or Evening Standard office and place over the grid in the Evening Standard. Reveal six keys and win a home worth over £100,000. Plus hundreds of cash prizes must be won. Two homes and £50,000 cash must be won through the Evening Standard keyhole. Game cards available all this week. No purchase necessary.
AM 7, Louise Lear's here with the weather, and you've got a very, very cold morning, haven't you?
Yes, it is a cold morning, but not quite as bad as yesterday. Temperatures on the outskirts today around 2 Celsius, 5 in the centre, but there's been another sort of general widespread ground frost this morning out on rural areas, so it's going to be sort of that cold and crispy start to the day, I think.
Lovely. A lot of people love that, of course, don't they? Really, we had a beautiful afternoon yesterday.
Yeah, I actually love weather like this. So it's the sort of weather that looks beautiful when you're inside in a nice, warm, central heated house. You know, it's lots and lots of sunshine around and lovely, lovely clear blue skies. But it is quite nippy when you get outside.
Yes. Is this unusual for early October?
It is quite unusual for early October, although I think in 1966 we had temperatures down to -7, so I don't think we should complain too much. But things are going to gradually pick up towards the end of the week.
When you say pick up, what do you mean? Get warmer?
Yes, everyday temperatures will increase and get slightly milder. By Friday we should be back to about about average, which is about 17 degrees, so not too bad. But as the temperatures pick up, that's because the cloud cover above us is increasing. So as these temperatures do pick up, there is a slight risk by Friday of one or two patchy showers, but nothing really too drastic, and back on course for sort of nice, dry, sunny, bright weather for Saturday.
Good stuff, indeed. Good stuff, indeed. Now, you're going to have a look at Europe, aren't you, in the next sequence of weather events, but is there any indication
general
that they're
picture,
getting
not,
sort of...
not too bad over there. I mean, if you are going on holiday for sort of a late summer holiday, then still down around the Costas and Portugal area is still pretty good, and so is Greece as well.
Good, but we'll have a look at Europe in more detail, Louise, when you next join us.
All right.
It's now 16 minutes to 7. The main news. Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams has clashed with the Ulster Unionists over peace in Northern Ireland. Strike action threatens the Tube, the first industrial action starting at 7:30 tomorrow evening. And a book to be published soon is understood to have new disclosures about the private life of the Princess of Wales.
Sixteen minutes to 7. As the debate on the standard and the future of London's hospitals continues, we're going to be talking directly this week to some of the doctors in the front line of healthcare in the capital. The government's plans became less clear this month when it disbanded the group originally set up to organise hospital closures. Now, for doctors, nurses and consultants, the future remains insecure. In the first of a series of reports allowing specialists themselves to talk about the pressures of the hospital service, Dominic Waghorn joined a former director of acute medicine at Guy's in his new job at Lewisham General Hospital.
Speaking to a surgeon, and you said that Dr. Jones, your senior registrar, who's been on leave, and I think the feeling is that...
Dr. Gordon Sladen has two perspectives on the plans for London hospitals. After a long career at Guy's, he's familiar with proposals to close down some of the capital's accident and emergency departments and thousands of its hospital beds. But as a consultant physician in Lewisham, he's worried about the burden of work that would put on London's other hospitals. He says district generals like Lewisham just wouldn't be able to take the extra strain.
The anxiety is, will the Trust have enough money available through its contracts to actually service those beds in terms of staff, nursing staff, medical staff, the inevitable costs that will accrue? Because we're told that we're going to have to make savings next year, and yet we're going to expand the services.
The government says London has more than its fair share of accident and emergency departments and 2,500 excess beds compared to the rest of the country. It wants a shift away from big central hospitals towards local care. But like many doctors in his position, Dr. Sladen says local hospitals just aren't ready for those changes yet.
Local services based on community care, which could help us to manage with far fewer beds, are just inadequate at the present time. It will take a long time to build up, and I think one would be thinking in terms of 5 to 10 years before major A&E departments in central London should close.
These deep reservations about the plans for London's major hospitals was some of the reasons Dr. Sladen felt he had to leave his top job as Deputy Director of Medicine at Guy's.
I was frustrated by the way things were going at Guy's, the interminable discussions about closures and cost-cutting. In my view, it is premature to close Guy's A&E at least for 5 years. And I think the threat to close it earlier made me feel distinctly uneasy about the future of Guy's, and I'm very glad that the government's decision to make these precipitate closures may be weakening.
It's now unclear how serious the government is about its reforms, with the deadlines for closures and mergers now passing without any major changes happening. Doctors complain about an uncertain and insecure future with no clear direction from the government. There's a fear crucial decisions about which hospitals should close are now being left to the market just to let politicians off the hook.
My concern is that we'll enter a period of prolonged drift and uncertainty, where we're all trying to maintain present services with four busy hospitals, and yet the money available to provide those services is declining, whereas plan changes may be appropriate.
Along with other colleagues, Dr. Slayton recognises some good points in current plans. Proposals to concentrate expensive, high-tech medicine and avoid costly duplication are generally popular, and many accept hospital beds are now being more efficiently managed. But with the current confusion and uncertainty, Dr. Slayton says the prevailing mood for doctors at his level is pessimistic.
It is depressing. It's one of the reasons why I'm glad I'm coming towards the end of my consultant career rather than starting it. But nevertheless, I'm determined to do what I can in the remaining years, whatever the circumstances.
That was the first in a series of reports around the hospitals in London, allowing specialists themselves to talk about the problems they face. The reporter was Dominic Waghorn. It's now 11 and a half minutes to 7. Time for sport, I think, Douglas.
Yes, indeed. Dominic Allen has that. And good morning.
Good morning,
quite
everyone.
Quite like old times.
It is, isn't it, just? Yes. And welcome back, everyone. Third Division Mansfield Town provided the shock of the Coca-Cola Football League Cup when they beat Leeds United 1-0 on aggregate. After winning the first leg 1-0 at Elland Road, they held Leeds to a goalless draw in the second leg at Field Mill. Watford beat Tottenham 3-2 on the night at White Hart Lane, but Spurs go through to the third round 8-6 overall. All the other London clubs in action are through as well, but Crystal Palace gave their supporters a fright. It was 4 minutes into injury time before they scored to level the tie against Lincoln at 1-1 on aggregate. Palace scored twice more in extra time to win 3-1. Chelsea beat Bournemouth by a goal to nil at Dean Court to go through 2-0 on aggregate, and Millwall held Sunderland to a 1-1 draw at Roker Park. Millwall won 3-2 over the two legs. The other clubs to reach the third round last night were Blackburn, Norwich, Nottingham Forest, Oldham and Sheffield Wednesday. There are 14 more second-round, second-leg games this evening, and there could be more surprises because in five of them, Premiership sides will have to come from behind to win their place in the third round. Martina Hingis, the 14-year-old Czech girl, won her first match as a professional in the European Indoor Tennis Championships in Zurich. She beat Patty Fendick in straight sets 6-4, 6-3. There are four race meetings today. They're at York, Haydock Park, Market Raisin and Toaster.
Well, when we have our discussion about football, there's only one place to start, and that's at Field Mill. Mansfield beating Leeds, a real stag party. I couldn't resist that, Mansfield's nickname being the Stags. That's the worst gag we'll hear all morning.
That should have been my line, all right.
But what a sensation.
Yeah, a good performance by Mansfield, and they were down to 14 men for the last quarter of an hour because they had Colin Hoyle sent off.
10 men.
Down to 10 men. What did I say?
14.
Oh, I think you're the other sport.
We know you're our rugby union correspondent, but I mean, this is ridiculous.
Yes, down to 10 men. But good performance by Mansfield. And, I mean, Leeds in trouble now. They haven't won a cup competition in something like 23 years. And if you think in the last couple of years, they've been beaten by, Oxford, Watford beat them, Sunderland as well. So not a good performance by Leeds at all.
And Crystal Palace.
Palace left it very late, didn't they? Into injury time at the end of that game before they equalised to make it 1-1 because they'd lost the first leg against Lincoln at Sinsel Bank 1-0. But then in extra time, Armstrong and Dyer got two more goals. So Palace win 3-1 on aggregate.
A good night on the whole for London clubs. Palace had a win and a very good night, really.
Yes. Chelsea beat Bournemouth by a goal to nil at Dean Court. Gavin Peacock scoring the winning goal for Chelsea there. Somewhat ironic because he used to play for Bournemouth, of course. Bournemouth, they're the club with the worst defensive record in the Football League, worse even than Tottenham's.
That's saying something, isn't it?
Chelsea only won 1-0. Palace we've dealt with, Watford beating Tottenham on the night, and Millwall, a good result for them up at Roker Park, drawing 1-1 with Sunderland. It's always difficult to get anything out of Roker Park, so Millwall go through 3-2 on aggregate.
And Spurs through, but 8-6 on aggregate. It's like the football of the 1950s, isn't it, really, where all these sloppy little goals kept going in.
Yes, and the Spurs' defensive record, I mean, it is awful at the moment, and if it hadn't been for Jurgen Klinsmann getting, four goals in the two legs there, I mean, Spurs could well have been out. Okay, they were missing the two Romanians, Popescu and Dumitrescu, last night because they're away preparing for Romania's European Championship game at the weekend. Also, Teddy Sheringham injured. But Spurs have really got a problem. I mean, if they concede six goals against Watford, with all due respect to Watford, Spurs have got to do something about their defence.
I think the most interesting news, with great respect to all the football clubs that were playing last night, for me, is the emergence of a new Martina on the tennis scene.
Yes, Martina Hingis. She beat Patty Fendick last night. Fendick ranked 45th in the world, I think. She beat her in straight sets and completely overshadowed her, what, if not her mentor, her mother's mentor. I mean, she was called Martina after Martina Navratilova because her mother used to play Davis Cup tennis with Navratilova. And Navratilova in action last night, okay, she struggled through to the second round, but overshadowed by this 14-year-old girl. And we're going to see another 14-year-old on the Virginia Slims tournament in about, I think, at the end of this month, a girl from Los Angeles. So, anyway, the 14-year-old certainly won last night and won very convincingly against Paddy Fendick, but of course they are going to bring this age limit into tennis, thankfully,
yes,
in the new year.
Yeah. Dominic, thank you. 7 minutes to seven.
Making your day with the best in curry is a detailed look at the problems of school bullying, with examples of how one London school is using pupils to fight the problem, plus a real breath of fresh air with the wildlife of London and the South East. We've much more too. Making your day starting at 1 this afternoon.
Robbie Vincent makes the day on London News Talk, 11:52 a.m.
We're hearing some of the comments that you've been phoning in with in just a few moments. You can call the free call number 0500 00 1152, or you can fax us on 0713712166. Back to the newspapers and some casting news, Douglas. I noticed in the Daily Mirror on page 2 that Hollywood has decided to film The Fall of the House of Windsor.
Yeah.
The title is Crisis, the story of the fall and fall of the House of Windsor. It's a blockbuster Hollywood film. Paramount has been secretly developing for 18 months. I wonder who you think is going to play the role of Diana, Princess of Wales.
Oh, now then.
Who would you cast?
Who would I cast?
Would you look around, you know, RADA here and the Royal Shakespeare Company and the National Theatre?
Is it going to be an American, do you think?
It is, I'm afraid, because the news is that Michelle Pfeiffer, for goodness sake, is going to be playing the Princess of Wales.
We're going to have to use our imagination.